fly 50 feet off the surface of the water, getting ready to spray dispersant. And that's about what he is right there, 50 feet off the water surface, and flying over. We fly 50 feet off the surface of the water, getting ready to spray dispersant. And that's about what he is right there, 50 feet off the water surface, and flying over basically all oil. Still again, basically within the zone 2 area, but approaching the zone 2, zone 1 boundary line. If you,
the contract.
It's a contract. I believe it belonged to, I think the company name is Southern Air Transport.
It came from where? You got it from?
I think the aircraft was originally staged in Arizona, but I think this particular aircraft was in California at the time.
You're listening again to live coverage of a congressional subcommittee hearing in Valdez, Alaska. Right now, the committee is viewing a videotape of various dispersant tests presented by the U.S. Coast Guard. The Coast Guard witnesses are Vice Admiral Clyde Robbins, who is the commander's.
The Alaska RRT members in Valdez met and discussed both oil burning and further dispersant application. At 1100, the full Alaska RRT met in teleconference. They discussed the previous information on hand concerning North Slope crude oil, which had indicated that the window for effective use of dispersants was normally within the 18 to 24 hour time frame. The federal on-scene coordinator, myself at that time, indicated that it was my belief that because of the calm seas and minimal winds, natural dispersion was minimal and continued field trial applications were appropriate. The Alaska RRT concurred with me, and even though the water was extremely calm and the effectiveness of dispersants questionable, further trial applications of dispersants should be conducted. The application would take place as soon as the aircraft arrived in Anchorage, was outfitted, and partially loaded. We had a partial load of 2,500 gallons of dispersant. The plane holds about 5,500 gallons.
Why partial load? Was that your requirement or just what was available?
No, that was what was suggested. So
Suggested by
Exxon. Yes,
right.
Exxon, let's see my next paragraph, but yes, sir. It was reported at that time, Saturday afternoon by Exxon, that there were approximately 400 barrels, 400 drums of dispersant in Anchorage. At approximately 1900, 7 p.m., the aircraft and equipment were ready and another dispersant trial application took place. It should be noted again that now it's been over 40 hours since the initial release of oil. The first test on Friday with the helicopter spray bucket was in the neighborhood of 16 hours after the initial release of oil. This Southern Air Transport C-130 aircraft with an installed airborne deliverable dispersant system, ADS-PAC, manufactured by Biegert Company, applied core exit 9527 to the leading edge of the oil slick, which is what you're seeing the several passes. That's two passes on the water. You can see the surface shift in discoloration. There was some discussion as to whether or not they even hit oil. That was raised by one of the ADEC people, but I can't confirm or deny that. But the leading edge of the oil had several fingers of oil stringing out towards Naked Island, and that's where the dispersants were applied. A dispersant use expert contracted for by Exxon, Mr. Gordon Lindblom, was on board the helicopter I was in with another Exxon representative who was doing the actual dispersant drop execution, giving the orders when to spray, when not to spray. Once again, as before, daylight, there was dwindling daylight, as you can see in the videotape, poor sunlight angle on the surface, extremely calm seas and winds of less than 15 knots prevented a good evaluation of the dispersant's effect on the oil slick. Some herding of the oil seemed to be taking place as a result of the light winds pushing the leading edges of the oil treated by the dispersant. The C-130 aircraft sprays approximately 150-foot swath width on the water. This method of application appeared to be very effective and will be utilized again in the morning when better sunlight conditions exist. As explained to myself by the Exxon expert, dispersing can be done only during daylight hours where there is good visibility. The spotter aircraft and dispersant aircraft must work as a team to be effective in the application of these dispersing chemicals. It is considered too dangerous to fly at low levels in the dark. Additionally, of note is, well, we did an oil burn test that night also, which separate subject.
If I could, just to follow this through. At this point, I don't hear you saying that Exxon said, we have a massive airlift capability here, we have a tremendous amount of chemicals available, and we would like to do a massive application of dispersants. That at no point, I mean, thus far, whatever they've asked for you to do, you've approved.
Yes, sir. There was never any hard push to use dispersants because in the expert, the fellow that they had on board the plane, he was not overly convinced of any great effect.
Do you have any tape recording of the expert or anything other than any?
Not intelligible. There's a couple of, hear some verbiage on the tape, but it's not.
Well, let me just read your statement and just ask you to reflect on it, and then I'll cede my time. Exxon did not receive authorization to use dispersants other than for two tests until the end of the three-day period, Sunday evening, March 26th. Exxon also did not receive permission to use open burning until mid-afternoon of the same day. We are confident that had we obtained prompt permission to use dispersants and open burning, the environmental damage from the spill would have been significantly mitigated. What you're hearing is Exxon's defense. I mean, this is what they're going to be using in court. I'd just like you to respond. I mean, from what you're telling us, this not receiving authorization other than for two tests. They asked for two tests, and you said, go ahead and do the two tests. They didn't say, we'd like to do two tests, now we'd like to do a massive application, and you said no. I mean, there was no request to use greater volumes that you denied.
No, sir. And I guess you could say that the first test was requested by Alyeska, the test with the spray bucket or the trial application. I hate to use the word test because these things have been tested in
the
controlled environment.
The bucket application was Alyeska's.
Okay. Yes, sir. And then the application on Saturday, Sunday morning, and Sunday afternoon were all basically limited by the fact you can't spray at night, so there was a time factor, and getting the equipment ready. I mean, I was ready to sit in the helicopter as long as we needed to see if the equipment was going to work effectively. And until the weather blew the oil away, we were still trying to find out whether the dispersant would have a positive effect on the oil.
Okay, so the statement, had we obtained prompt permission to use dispersants, I'll leave out the burning, someone else will, I think, follow up on that, damage from the spill would have been significantly mitigated. They had permission.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Let's see if we can just, for a second, if I can just follow up on that before I recognize Mr. Vento. Admiral, this is obviously, we're down to the core here. The state said that they did not deny either Alyeska or Exxon the ability to use dispersants had they so chosen to do that. You're the third party here. Did the Coast Guard deny Exxon the ability to use dispersants?
To my knowledge, they did not.
Mr. McCall?
No, sir, we did not.
Thank you. Mr. Pinto?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just came back. I had left my colleagues to the hearings here and went out and looked at the parks yesterday, and I was appalled. I saw no activity going on with regards to surface recovery of oil products. I mean, we're sort of left with the picking up the dead birds on the beach at Katmai and guarding the workers with shotguns. There are bears all over the place out there that are, and other scavengers are picking up everything. And yet, as I look at the plan, the testimony, there is no, the plan submitted by Exxon and by Alyeska stops at Kenai Fjords and stops. There's nothing. In other words, you got 350 miles of shoreline at Kenai Fjords, and 250 at Katmai, and you've got all sorts of stuff floating around the water out there. I guess there probably is a skimmer out there somewhere, but they're not. That's been floating around, and it's coating the entire beach area. I'm just appalled at what is taking place. They picked up thousands of birds, and yesterday they had a couple of otters. One was alive, one was dead, completely covered with this syrupy goop, that byproducts of oil. I think generally the Coast Guard's doing what they can. I appreciate the cooperation we've had, and I understand that there's severe stress here in terms of being stretched to the maximum in terms of equipment and so forth. So the need to understand, I guess, this complicates the job somewhat. First of all, the Coast Guard controls the traffic in and out of the port here, is that correct? In other words, they're responsible for the navigation and the approval of different changes of course.
No, sir, that's not correct. We do not give course commands or helm or rudder commands to a ship. No, sir, we do not.
So who does the control of that?
The master of the ship.
Master of the ship, but who authorizes the bearings, and who authorizes the location or the of the regulates that?
Comes close to positive control. In Prince William Sound, and because of the pipeline system and the tanker traffic, the only area of that comes close to positive control, if you use the phrase, would be Valdez Narrows, where we can tell a ship you can, cannot come in on a routine basis, when and not.
Well, what about, we've received this testimony or this statement when we were in, from the Columbia Glacier, the ice flows or bergs coming off of there. In other words, you can't stop transportation or traffic when there is a significant number of icebergs or flows in the corridor.
If there is a number of icebergs or any situation that poses a threat to navigation that's warranted closing of the port, I have the authority to close the port of Valdez to commercial traffic. Yes, sir.
You didn't close it in this instance. You made a
no, sir.
You didn't make, in other words, and so this is a normal procedure. As there's been an increase in the number of ice flows or bergs at this time.
Since this winter, we've seen the beginning in December, January timeframe because of the cold weather that we've had. It seems we're seeing an increase in ice that enters into the traffic lanes from Columbia Glacier, from Columbia Bay. But it's dependent on a lot of things, wind particularly, you know, wind coming out of the mountains, blowing the ice into the channel.
You know, upon coming up, they presented us with the Command Center Incident Memo, which of May 4th, which I'm sure that you're familiar with. This is the location. This comes out of the Coast Guard.
All public affairs.
The Command Center Incident Memo. It's on Coast Guard stationery.
Yeah, I think that's a public affairs publication.
Well, it has a fact sheet on here. Are you familiar with the information on this fact sheet and how they arrive at these facts?
Well, I'm not at the moment because I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, no, I mean, okay, well, it says fact sheet. It says oil recovered. 49,000 barrels.
Oh, that is the operations report that is put out by Exxon each evening. We have an operations report.
So they're responsible for this information on your letterhead.
Well, the transmission sheet is transmitting the information that Exxon's put out. Yes, sir.
84,000 barrels of oil evaporated. Do you agree with any of this?
I would, if you give me those numbers and you say, do you specifically agree with this number? I'd say, well, it's possible.
Well, anything is possible, but what I'm saying is I'm talking about something that comes out in a Coast Guard fact sheet, you know, or a Coast Guard stationery at the head, and I got a fact sheet attached from Exxon behind, which is preposterous.
I would say if that's the way the reader is led, it certainly is, it's not appropriate.
Well, it doesn't say anything about on here about Exxon. I don't know if I got the full version here or not.
I think what, are you sure that isn't faxed to somebody at their request, and all we were doing is sending along, although it looks like a typed sheet. I really, it's hard to comment it without not having seen it.
Well, I understand, but I assume that I am not trying to create. I think my understanding of it and my conveyance of the message here is accurate.
I would hate to stand behind those figures. I'll tell you that right now.
Well, I would suggest that because of the nature of the way it's presented, that I don't know. Maybe I don't have the right version, but it looks like it's pages aren't numbered or anything. But I assume that it's put together properly. And take it down to him. The concern I had is under the contingency plan, they said the most that could evaporate was 15%. This indicates 33% has evaporated. I don't have another copy of it, but as an example of the sort of information that is apparently in this information. And, of course, that concerns me that would occur that we'd be presented in that manner. For instance, on page 3, if you look at it, talks about the amount that they burned, 19,000 barrels. Do you agree with that being the amount that was burned, Mr. McCall? Barrels.
What? I couldn't say
anything's possible, but is it probable?
Probably not.
Or evaporated, or
for a second, your earlier response was you could not stand by those figures.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
Thank you.
Well, I just think it's important to get on the record that we got information going out here that tends to suggest that this problem is being dealt with, and we've got all this oil out there still floating around. I mean, the initial plan said that 15% would be the maximum amount that would be evaporated. And now we can see here it's over 30% that they're suggesting has evaporated. That's Exxon's answer. In other words, I guess this comes under the clause that nature will take care of it. You know, nature is not taking care of it. What's happened is nature is getting taking the hit. That's what's happening in Kenai Fjords. That's what's happening in Katmai. And that's what's happening up and down this sound, is that we are paying a terrible price in terms of the impact, in terms of the natural environment, in terms of obviously commercial fishing and a whole host of things that we have no basis on which to understand at this time. We just don't have the information with regard to it. I hope that we can get that straightened out, and I hope that the Coast Guard Public Relations Office would cease and desist from sending out information that is that it cannot stand behind. We got enough problems without having the imprimatur of the Coast Guard placed on these preposterous types of statements, in my judgment. Now, if I misunderstood, or that this came to me in a form that where there were the proper reservations put on it, I would certainly stand corrected. But I think that this is an accurate representation of what you're doing. What are the plans beyond? In other words, they submitted a contingency plan that stops. What are the plans to go beyond this? Obviously, the Coast Guard is out there working already with the volunteers. This plan is being rejected, and this is going to be revised. Is that correct, to take into account for the fact that this is going to go into Bristol Bay and so forth?
Well, certainly first of all, I would like to say that right now, to the best of our knowledge, and the people that are making the measurements, NOAA and DEC and others, there is no threat to Bristol Bay in that area. That is still of concern to us, but we haven't seen anything that far south.
Was it accurate that at one point that there was some suggestion it would never reach Kenai Fjords and never reach Katmai? Wasn't that correct also? Wasn't NOAA saying that by the time it reached there it would be dissipated?
Not to my knowledge. I never heard. I've been here for 4 weeks, and I don't think in that time anybody suggested that it might not meet there, might not reach there.
Mr. McCall, you were here earlier.
Yes, sir. In the earlier stages, the oil was still within Prince William Sound, so there was no, it's expanded from Prince William Sound, but in the
Well, it certainly has expanded from Prince William Sound. I guess if they had, had they ever demonstrated a capacity to really pick this stuff up successfully? How much has been picked up, do you think, so far?
Well, the report is 50,000 barrels.
Well, I read that. I don't.
There is. That's probably, of those figures you read, is probably we could stand behind those better than the other ones because that is a measured volume. However, there is water mixed with that and seaweed and a number of other things. So
and birds.
And birds, probably. Those kind of numbers are very difficult to come up with. The pickup to the southwest has been very difficult because of just the things we mentioned. It's thick and it's very difficult to deal with.
Well, at any time was the pickup successful? When it wasn't thick, when it was initially dumped in the water, they picked up 3,000 barrels of whatever, water and oil, in the first 3 days with a capacity of 100 or about 96,000 at least on the labels. That's about 1%. Of what the capacity was, the so-called capacity of the equipment.
Well, I would have to say that in the earlier periods would have been the best time to pick it up because that's when it's least weathered, and no, the efforts to pick it up were not effective.
Well, do you think that they're effective right now?
Well, they're as effective. Most of it that's going ashore is ashore. And so
I disagree with that. I was out at Kenai. We saw all of this moose in the water. It is moving depending upon the direction of the wind. And at Katmai, I'm telling you that there is some ashore. I wish that I could say that most that's ashore in the Sound is probably ashore. I don't know. They're still floating around out here, 75,000 barrels in the Sound yet, isn't there?
No, sir, there is not. I would be very surprised if there's that much out there.
But now, it has to move somewhere, doesn't it? It's going to have to move, and it's likely if it follows the current pattern that it will all, again, part of it or some of it, the sheen, the other products. And, of course, the sheen is we don't know what all the impacts of that are. That is part of the oil component, so that isn't ashore yet, is it? And it could very well end up ashore, right?
There is sheen there. That is the sheen is with any devices we have these days is very difficult to.
I understand you can't pick it up, but when you say that everything that is going to go ashore is ashore.
No, I didn't say that, Mr. Congressman. What I said was that most of it that is out there or has been out there has gone ashore. There are still some, and I too have. I visited Katmai Bay on Saturday, and you're absolutely right. There is some still in the water line. There are isolated bays in those areas where there is oil in the water. They are working to pick that up. We have.
There isn't anyone picking up. Yesterday, as I went up and down in a 10-hour period, there wasn't anyone picking up anything in Kenai Fjords or Katmai. Now, I don't know if Sunday was a day off or what, but there were some workers working on the beach picking up the dead animals. They're dealing with that. The dead animals are the priority. I don't disagree with that, but I just didn't see anything going on. Maybe I didn't see
all the work. The cleanup on the beach, you're absolutely right, in that area has not started. Today, they're making the archaeological survey that's necessary, and because that is a wilderness area and a park area, we have to do it in accordance with the requirements of Interior and the archaeological concerns. And that, I am told, will start today, and that will be a rake and shovel operation, which I think in those areas will be very effective. Now, there is oil beneath the surface there on those sandy beaches. We discussed that on Saturday. I discussed it with Interior and the Park Service. They feel that we should leave that to see whether it weathers and what happens to it rather than dig it up.
Well, we know it's going to happen. I mean, I've looked at some of the research on this, and that's once that gets below the surface, it's under the sand. I mean, because the sand, the littoral movement moves it all around, covers it. And so the fact is, the longer they postpone picking up this heavy tar, syrupy-like material, it's going to get buried by the sand. It's going to be there. There is a lot of oil in these, and it will take decades to dissipate based on the research. It'll take decades. So I don't know. I don't think that the Park Service has in any way disapproved any of the actions yet, any attempt to pick up any of the product, have they? They have not disapproved any action to pick up the the contaminated product, have they?
No, only that they don't want us digging in the beaches and that sort of thing, and
well,
I think that's understandable.
There's a lot of damage, and it's a lot of it is buried. I agree it has to be picked up. They say they're going to start today, but it's, the effort is going to, you know, based on the amount of time it's going to take to pick that up is going to be very difficult, and they only have, what, how many workers do they have assigned to that? To that 700 miles of beach area.
Well, I have some difficulty quoting those numbers, Mr.
I know. I just want to know in terms
because
of the Katmai and Kenai Fjords, how many workers have they got over there in that area that are working the beaches in that 700-mile area?
Well, in the 700-mile area, which I hasten to say is not all covered with oil.
No, I agree, but...
And they are going to have 60 to 100 people walking those beaches, and that probably will move along quite rapidly in those areas.
Well, in just Halo Bay, for instance, they picked up 1,000 birds.
Yes, sir.
Well, thank you.
We'll do a second round. Mr. Durbin.
Thank you. Captain, did I hear your earlier testimony correctly that the Coast Guard crew first arrived at the Exxon Valdez at 3:30 in the morning?
Yes, sir.
And can you tell me when the corpsman arrived to take the blood sample from the captain?
I'm not sure. I believe he arrived probably around 9, 10 o'clock in the morning.
Do you know when the first request was made for someone to be sent out to the Valdez for either a blood sample or some type of test to determine the alcohol content of the captain's blood?
Within an hour after his arrival on board, between 3:30 and 4:30.
And if I recall correctly, Admiral Yost has testified, and I believe I've read in other accounts, that there was some difficulty in securing a person who was trained to take this test. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. And again, my executive officer phoned me on the telephone, or contacted me via the Marine MARSAT, the Maritime Satellite telephone connection, which is on our recorded line. He indicated that he perceived a problem with the master and requested that I get someone out here to take blood alcohol tests. So I said I would, and immediately contacted the local state trooper, or attempted to contact the local Alaska state trooper, Mr. Jim Alexander, who happened to be out of town. So then the next person that came to my mind was the Alaska State Fish and Wildlife Trooper, Mike Fox, who I contacted, woke him up and told him what we had and asked him if he could do it, the job, and he said yes, and he said he would swing by the police station and pick up whatever equipment he needed, and then he would come on out. So we got him out on board the ship. And when he got out there, I guess there was a miscommunication because he didn't have the equipment that he needed to do the test. And they radioed that information back to me. That's when, I guess maybe that was about 8:30 or so in the morning. And I realized that we had a Coast Guard corpsman at our unit a day or so before going through medical records. And he was on his way out to the airport to fly back to Anchorage. And at that time, I figured, well, if the state trooper isn't there, let's keep it within the Coast Guard spectrum. Got a hold of him, got him to go out. And at the same time, we learned that there were test kits on board the Exxon Valdez, which is what the corpsman used to draw the samples.
So the test kits were on board the tanker from the start?
Yes, sir.
Just weren't aware of that fact?
No, we weren't aware of that fact. In fact, I found that out through contacts with Exxon, speaking
with
Exxon.
Were any representations or information given to you about the condition of the captain when the first request was made for this test?
Excuse me, sir?
Were any representations or statements made to you about the condition of the captain when this test was first requested?
Yes, sir. My executive officer said he felt that he smelled alcohol on the breath of the master.
Can I ask another question? Admiral, as I understand it, the Coast Guard has no authority to review the contingency plans for oil spills. Is that correct?
Well, as I understand it, we review the operation of the shoreside facility, and that, if that has to have a contingency plan, yes. In this case, this was a state requirement for a contingency plan for Prince William Sound. We did not, we were in on that. We were aware of it. We exercised with them, I believe, did we not, Steve? And so we were aware of it, but it wasn't our, we weren't in the review process.
Do I take it from that statement then that the Coast Guard never stated any opinion as to the adequacy of that contingency plan?
I think Steve could answer.
No, sir. Not. There's no written statement as to the adequacy of it. No, sir.
And there is no established procedure for the Coast Guard to review such a plan in relation to its adequacy for such a disaster?
No, sir. There hasn't been.
All right. Do I understand that subsequent to this accident, some spokesman for the Coast Guard has stated that they believe this contingency plan for an oil spill was inadequate?
Well, I might have been quoted saying that because I think it.
Could you tell me why you feel it's inadequate or it was inadequate?
Well, because it didn't work. Well, you know, that I doubt very much if we went around the United States and looked at all the contingency plans that are available for an oil spill, that any of them could handle a spill of this magnitude. I have very strong doubt whether there's anything that could be there quick enough, taking all into account where it happened, the time of day, and the everything that that went on, the length of time that the oil went out into the water. I doubt very much if it was containable. When they put a hole in the vessel, the fat was in the fire.
I guess I'm going to ask you then to take this a step further. Judging the plan inadequate because it didn't work may suggest deficiencies in the plan or deficiencies in execution of the plan. Is it your conclusion that there were deficiencies in either or both aspects?
Well, not being an absolute expert on the plan, but it said my understanding was that they were supposed to be on scene in 5 hours, within 5 hours, and my understanding is that they weren't, so certainly there was a problem there. I don't think from anything I've seen so far and from what I've been told that the plan really covered a 250,000 barrel spill.
Part of the plan stated, and this is a plan submitted by Alyeska to the state of Alaska, that 50% of the oil that had been spilled in the hypothetical 200,000 barrel spill could be recovered. Were you aware of that statement in the plan?
No, sir, I was not.
All right. Do you believe at this point, some 45 days or so after the incident, that 50% of the oil has been recovered?
No, I don't think it's been recovered.
Do you believe it is possible that they will ever recover 50% of the oil that had been spilled in this incident?
I have serious doubts.
You stated in your opening statement that Exxon has been very cooperative in the cleanup effort. I think it was a very positive statement in relation to that relationship between the Coast Guard and Exxon. But I also noted there are some pretty clear signals that you feel that additional resources will be needed from Exxon in order to meet any type of September deadline. Can you tell me at the present time what you believe will be necessary?
Well, I'm kind of on the hot seat here. I'm supposed to have this federal responsibility in hand by 15 September. I can't tell you now whether the number of people that they've suggested and the number of forces, the amount of force, is adequate to meet that 15 September. We simply don't have enough data to be able to do that. I'm very uncomfortable with the force structure that they have suggested, and as a hip shot, I would like to double it just for insurance. But until we get a little better data on, first of all of the, as Congressman Vento said, we still have some that's in the water along the shorelines. That has to be collected and picked up. There are not all the beaches have been surveyed by the people that have to do those surveys. So there's some real unknowns. We don't know. They're suggesting that there are 365 miles of beach that have been impacted by the oil. Until we get those in hand and are more sure of them, I can't tell you how much force structure they need.
If Exxon and the Coast Guard and all interested and involved parties proceed according to plan, what can the people of Prince William Sound expect on September 15th? What is your goal as of that date?
Well, my goal is to have, I call it a gross cleanup. I want to see the major amounts of oil cleaned up by then. What we're seeing is, on Smith Island is a good example. The oil there is, depending on who measures it, is 3 or 4 feet below the surface into the rocks and stones. Each time the tide comes in, it re-oils. So they've worked some 9 or 10 days on that beach area and that shoreline area, and it's still a long ways from being squeaky clean. I don't expect the beaches at the end of the summer to be squeaky clean, but what I would like to see is to be to the point where re-oiling is not occurring and that they will be not doing any more damage to the environment. And then the final clean-up, I fully expect there will be some places that are clean. There will be some places that the impact is removed. In other cases, in the more heavily oiled beaches, there will be still work to be done on when 15 September passes, but it won't threaten us through the winter, and then we will have to come back, review the area in the spring, and then direct cleanup, continued cleanup in certain areas.
My last question to you, Admiral, relates to a topic that's more closely attuned to my own committee, the Appropriations Committee, and that is the question of the resources and personnel available to the Coast Guard, particularly here in Alaska and at the Port of Valdez. We have read press accounts that some half of the personnel that were previously assigned here were assigned a different duty last year, and that your complement in Valdez is about one half of what it was a year ago. We've also heard statements that there have been requests from the Coast Guard to improve the radar and navigation systems available to them in directing traffic through this port, and that unfortunately those requests have not been honored. Could you state for the record your comments or observations in relation to these facts?
Well, there's no question in my mind that they, I know that they cut back the number of people here. Right now, the way they're running the vessel traffic system at Commander McCall's operation is that they put more people, they're doing more plotting and that sort of thing, and they aren't manned for it. That's going to take more people. I think in each one of the cases, not only Valdez, but every place where we're adding, where we're handling a lot of traffic, ship traffic, we need to really look at those areas and see what needs to be done. Through the years, as we haven't had accidents, I think everyone can share a little blame in it, have gotten a little complacent over what is going on, and it's time. This is going to cause a real close examination. We see it here today of these things, and then decisions made in any particular case.
Thank you very much, Admiral. And I might add that one of the real dilemmas facing Congress is, of course, our budget deficit. We face that every day. And I might also add that the Coast Guard's new assignment in relation to drug interdiction has complicated this situation as well.
Absolutely.
I think Coast Guard's been forced to transfer assets and resources that otherwise would have been dedicated to its initial function and mission. And let me close by just complimenting you and the men and women in uniform in all branches who are working so hard to coordinate this effort. We've had a chance to see it personally and up close. We're very proud of what you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Admiral, I'm encouraged by your response to Congressman Durbin, and given Congressman Vento's concerns about the peninsula, that you think perhaps this effort should be doubled. One of our concerns yesterday was that representations were made to the people in the state of Alaska and to the United States about this contingency response system, and now we find out, well, that was really the manufacturer's rated capacity of these vessels, and of course there's all of these problems that interfered. My concern is now that we have a relatively small window of opportunity between now and September 15th to get this oil out of the environment. And we are being we're given a plan suggested by Exxon. I do not think that the people of the United States want the perpetrator of the crime defining the restitution. And right now, you're the public arbiter of that decision. And what we don't need is to hear in September, well, we could have gotten there, but there were more rainy days, or there were higher seas than we had anticipated, or the ship didn't show up, the plane didn't make it on time. This is a tough, remote environment. And if anything, we should err on the side of having too many resources at this point, because the air and not having enough early on have complicated this drive. So I must tell you that I'm encouraged, and I hope that that your hip shot will in fact be turned into policy, because I think there we can start to rebuild some of the confidence of the public. So I appreciate that response, Captain McCall. In your response to one of the members' questions, I think it was Congressman Vento about you don't do bearings and you don't do helm and rudder sets for the ships. In your response, you said because of the pipeline system. What do you mean?
I was referring to the establishment of the VTS at Valdez itself. Had it not been for the tanker traffic, there more than likely would not be a vessel traffic service in Valdez at all.
But is this any different than any other port? Does the Coast Guard does or does not control the traffic differently in the port of San Francisco or the port of Long Beach than they do here? Do you have more or less of the same authority here?
Every port that, where there's traffic management at all, there's only about four of them where we actually manage traffic to any extent at all. Valdez is one of them because it was in the legislation, as I recall. Puget Sound is another one. We've had San Francisco, we've had a vessel traffic system for some time. Our attempts to operate one in New York, I believe the New Orleans one, both of those have been closed down. There's a great deal of resistance to traffic control in our ports.
What's different between your ability to, I don't know, is there a difference in your authority to manage the flow of traffic in San Francisco Bay than there is in the Port of Valdez?
In no case do we actually control traffic.
Okay.
There are a couple of variances to that where there are traffic lights on bridges and that sort of thing where you could say we were controlling traffic. But generally, it's a system that has been set up to provide assistance to the mariner and tell him what is going on and what's coming his way so he can react.
You can, however, close the port.
Yes, the captain of the port can close a port if there is a safety problem. For instance, in the case of a collision or a particularly dangerous situation, he can issue an emergency captain of the port order and close the port. I have to hastily add, though, that whenever he does that, he's under a lot of pressure to get it back open again.
How many times has the Port of Valdez been closed? You know?
Well, portions of the port have been closed at various times for spills
You closed the port after the Valdez, right?
Yes, sir.
Because and that was a complete closure.
That was a complete closure, mainly because of the large volume of oil there. We didn't want any traffic going through, you know, bringing this slip above
it. When have you previously closed the port?
We closed the port, late January. We closed the port for approximately a day and a half due to high winds through Valdez Narrows.
I understand from newspaper accounts, and then I have your response, in closing the port after the Valdez accident, that immediately the shippers wanted to know, obviously, how you could rearrange to get the port open, and that's understandable. Let me ask you this. Would you consider that pressure?
That's routine pressure, I would say. There's always a concern how long you're going to disrupt the flow of traffic.
When you closed the port during the storms in January, what happened there?
Yes, sir. I had gotten a phone call from representatives of the Department of Energy expressing concern about the interruption of the flow.
Is that routine pressure?
No, sir.
The Department of Energy called you and asked you what?
How long we anticipated having the port closed and
were they just casually interested, or were they?
Well, at the time they were concerned because I believe the pipeline, the flow rate was what it is now, a little over 2 million barrels a day, but their storage capacity was fairly high. I mean, it was fairly full at the terminal. The backlog of tankers that it would have created by closing the port, obviously it was a concern to them because every tanker you hold up here arrives down in the lower 48, that much time later.
But that call was not interpreted by you.
That was the first time I've gotten called by the Department of Energy, and it got my attention, yes, sir.
What was your response?
We'll try to get the port open as soon as it's safe.
The request to change lanes by the Valdez was made for what reason?
The master, when he was departing, sighted ice in the downbound tanker lane, and I guess apparently in the separation zone also, and had advised us that he was going to be crossing into the separation zone and maybe into the inbound lane, and he would give us a call.
You have any way of verifying whether that's accurate or not?
No, we have no way of sighting ice. It doesn't show up very well on radar. Also.
Now's the time to talk. That's right.
If you have anything you want to say, say it now.
The court reporter is changing her tape in her recording machine. This is a formal congressional hearing that we're listening to, and all of the proceedings are recorded by a court reporter as well as by mechanical recording means.
Well, let me
area coverage device.
We're listening to Commander McCall and Vice Admiral Roberts being questioned by the committee.
Is the notion that a master says he does not believe that it's safe to continue transit, even to the extent that he would prefer to be in the other lane or in the separation zone,